So I would like to start out by introducing the folks we have with us today. We have Karen Folk out of Urbana, Illinois, and John DiCepoli, and also Bert Whitehead. Karen, as I said, joins us from the Champaign-Urbana area. Karen is licensed as a CFP and has a PhD in Family and Consumption Economics from the University of Illinois. She's been involved in consumer education for over 20 years and has held positions at Oklahoma State University, the University of Illinois, and the University of Wisconsin. As a state cooperative extension specialist, Karen authored over 20 publications on money management topics. She started her own business in 1999. Folk Financial Planning offers sound financial planning advice to middle-income clients. As a fee-only certified financial planner practitioner, Karen receives no commissions from the purchase or sale of products. And her mission is to be a trusted advisor who helps ordinary people make smart choices about money. John DiCepoli has spent more than 24 years in the accounting profession. After graduating from college, he worked for the Big Eight CPA firm KPMG, where he was introduced to audits of banks and mutual funds. John's desire to work with the public led him to a relationship management role in the private client group of Fort Washington Investment Advisors. Frustration set in there because he wanted to do much more for his clients. While at an APA conference, he met several ACA members, and in 2004, he decided to join ACA and go out on his own. Never before did John do a happy dance while at work, but now he does so after nearly every meeting. His time is his own. He's able to do all the volunteer work he wants, serve on the school board or church council, coach his kids, and work with people he likes. Bert Whitehead developed the original Cambridge system, founded Cambridge Connection Incorporated and ACA, the Alliance of Cambridge Advisors. Bert has a BA in psychology, an MBA in finance, and a law degree. He started practicing as a tax attorney and fee-only financial planner, serving primarily executives, professionals, and small business owners in 1972. Bert is the author of Why Smart People Do Stupid Things with Money and 9 other books relating to personal finance. Bert's been selected by Worth Magazine as one of the best 100 personal financial advisors in the United States every year since 1994. He is regularly quoted in a variety of national publications and has been a guest on Fox Moneyline. Bert was featured on a PBS television special which ran nationwide in 2006 through 2008 titled Why Smart People Do Stupid Things with Money. So there you have it. There's our intro to the folks here at your disposal. And you just get to ask us your questions, and they can tell you a little bit about life as an ACA member.
Wow. Well, first of all, I'm flattered that I get so much attention, and thank you very much for being generous, so generous with your time. I consider myself a veteran of the business. I've been involved with wealth advisory work for 15 to 20 years. I got my start on Wall Street in the early 90s and kind of migrated over to the private client space and then subsequently into the financial planning advisory role. And I'm currently located in the Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area, where I'm at a very established RIA firm and having a fairly successful career here, but looking to kind of branch out on my own. And one of the pending questions in the back of my mind is what type of model should I utilize if I were to branch out on my own? And one of the things in the back of my mind, of course, is that I very much enjoy the people I'm working with right now. I would not represent to anybody that I would take clients from my existing firm. I would probably start cold turkey. And that's just out of respect to the firm that I'm at right now and just wanting to kind of start my own operation from the ground up. So with that said, I'd be very interested to hear how somebody might kind of step into the ACA platform and get started with basically no legacy clients or assets to speak of and kind of work their way up and build a very successful practice that is scalable and ultimately, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road could be sold through, you know, which would be some type of liquidity event on the exit strategy. So that's kind of where my mind's at. I'm just wondering if each of you could kind of comment on the potential utilizing the ACA model and how we could go ahead and move forward. I did look at ACA a number of years ago, but never ended up kind of getting sidetracked in this current opportunity that I'm at. And so I'm a little bit rusty on what the what all the bells and whistles are with ACA. So maybe you guys could also comment on that to the extent that there's time.
Okay. This is John DiCepoli, and I practice in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'll just give you a little brief, you know, how I got started. In Cincinnati, and as well as basically most of Ohio, NAPFA has a pretty strong presence, and that's the association I don't know if you're familiar with, but they are the leaders in fee-only financial planning. The ACA, I think, is the largest subset of membership within NAPFA. And one of the things that I did in starting my practice was, I went to all the other fee-only advisors in town. And what I introduced myself, I told them what I was doing, that I was getting into the business, and what I felt was my area of expertise and this and that. And what's unique about that I have found with NAPFA, especially here in Cincinnati, and I have found it to be true with other folks in Ohio, because there's a big contingent in Columbus, and there's some as well up in Cleveland, the three biggest cities in Ohio, that even though we are in competition with each other, it's really more of a, you know, for a goofy term, cooperation, in that, you know, there are some folks that work really, really well with all the P&G retirees, and there's other folks that work with divorce clients or widows or whatever. And, you know, as I explained where I would like to position myself, I, even to this day, 5 and 6 years later, still get the vast majority of my referrals from other NAPFA members in town. A call might come into them. They say, well, gee, you don't really meet my practice very well. Why don't you talk to John? He's also here in Cincinnati. That's been a great way for me to grow my practice.
And John, what is the primary driving criteria for somebody to refer business? Because this other NAPFA member has a higher investment minimum?
Yeah. Here in Cincinnati, like I said, most of the other NAPFA members have higher minimums than I do. I don't happen to have a minimum. But what's interestingly enough, a lot of times those other these referrals from other NAPFA members, you know, it might be that they only have $400,000 of assets under management right now, but they have $2 million in a 401k somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're still a high net worth type of client for me.
Sure.
But you know, as far as active assets under management that someone else that's under a typical AUM model can't bill on. And, you know, like I said, oftentimes it's more that they just don't – that might be one criteria they don't fit. It might be that they – like I said, there's a number of firms in Cincinnati who have a more narrow niche for what clients they want to work with. Like I said, there's some that only work with P&G retirees. But if they were on a local news show or had an article published and, you know, their name's in the paper or, you know, whatever, so they might get a handful of calls that month, and two of those people aren't P&G retirees just calling to say, hey, can you take me as a client? They might say, well, no, why don't you call John? So like I said, I went around to all the other NAPFA members in town, and we have – We have now three NAPFA study groups here in Cincinnati, and we all know each other. And it's not uncommon for someone to say, well, you're a better fit for this client, for this firm over here. If you're in California, I would venture to guess that you have a pretty good presence, NAPA presence within your area, that you know, certainly that you should be able to do a similar type of thing, just introduce yourself to the rest of the membership. Now, again, where you position yourself, and again, initially it could be anyone that, you know, breathes, but nonetheless, it's a good way to get a foothold in the community. I mean, of course, there's always the traditional ways, you know, of building a practice, but I'm just giving you something specific within how ACA members operate. We operate, you know, with a fee-only model, and NAPA is sort of the governing body, I guess you could say, of fee-only. So there's a mechanism right there built into the model that helps you grow your business. And I'll let Karen and Bert address that too.
Well, I can tell that my business is quite a bit different because I'm in Central Illinois, and I started in '99, and I was the only fee-only planner in this whole area. I'm 2.5 hours south of Chicago. So I would say I got about a third of my clients from NAPA referrals, and they weren't from other NAPA advisors. They were just through the NAPA referral network.
Okay.
And then the other third I got from people that I knew in the community. I'd been here a long time. I was a career changer, so I started out without any clients. Although I was working for someone who retired, and I did get a couple of clients to start with that were kind of wanting to work with my former employer, and then he was leaving, and they waited and started with me once I got registered. And then I did, you know, I went and visited attorneys and accountants and various people in town. I had to find estate planning attorneys to refer clients to anyway for that part of their financial planning. So, it, you know, it's kind of a diversity of places that people came from. The thing I can say about Cambridge and using their system is I signed up for it as soon as I knew that I was going to go into business for myself. You know, I had been working for someone else, and I wasn't really looking to start my own business, but that was sort of the only route I could take if I wanted to not sell products on commission. So I went ahead, and just the whole format of how to do the plan and also the selling technique, because I'd never sold anything except Girl Scout cookies before then, you know, how to show, there's a whole method of a certain sequence of preliminary meeting and so on, and ways that you show your value to the client to get them to agree to write you this, you know, write a check for the services, because since I don't do AUM, you know, they have to actually write me the check for the plan. That was just invaluable. I wouldn't have made it without that framework to work with and to follow. So that's how I got started.
Has your model evolved over the years? I mean, you mentioned that they would write you a check for the plan up front in the early days. Is that still true today?
Yeah, I do now. We do now charge quarterly because as our fees have gotten bigger, we run into the, you know, not taking $500 for the 6 months in advance issue. So a couple of years ago, we went to charging quarterly. At first, I only had the clients with the larger renewal fees pay, I think, twice a year. But then it just made more sense. And I actually am now in a business succession planning mode. I took on a young associate a few years ago as a paraplanner. He's now got his CFP. He's actually officially now a 50% business partner. We just signed an operating agreement and made an LLC, and he's going to buy that 50. He has a promissory note to pay me that 50% back over the next 5 years. And then,
you know, we're looking to eventually probably add another planner and become a multi-member firm. So, you know, I have never had any problems with my clients.
Okay. Talk if you could about two things I'd kind of like to get, and I realize, Bert, you haven't chimed in yet. I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because I heard you comment on what I'm about to ask a number of years ago. And my comment number one is, my question number one, and I'm hoping that the three of you could kind of elaborate a little bit, is talk if you could, or comment. I'd like to hear in each of your own words what is the unique value proposition to a client that's on the other side of the table from you, that's looking at three or four firms, and you are the one that is presenting the ACA system. So what is the unique value proposition that you're presenting to the client in that initial 3 or 4 minutes that you're trying to win this, knowing that the client has other options when looking at other wealth managers and so forth? So maybe that's question number one, is how do you differentiate yourself from the other options that the client has available? And then number two is, I'd kind of like to get on the table, what is the scalability of somebody that really dedicates to themselves to this model? I mean, I got my start on Wall Street, and I perfectly accept that, you know, I'd be taking a step back and start a practice from zero, but I'd really like to know, what is the potential here on this model? What is the typical, if you look at the top practices that are dedicated to the ACA system, do they cap out at a certain income level because of the scalability and the way the compensation works, the fee schedule works, or is it the sky's the limit? I'd like to know a little bit about that. The one of the benefits of the typical percentage of AUM model is that, you know, every additional asset you bring in the door contributes to the bottom line, and I it's not clear in my mind how scalable this system is, and so I was hoping that you could comment on that as a second question.
Well, I can address some of that, and I think, and I don't know that Cambridge, the ACA model, is really what some people are looking for when they're looking and going to the business. And I think in general, certainly in my practice, I don't do investment management.
Okay.
I mean, I do work with my clients on their investments. And I have a lot of wealth management clients, and our firm is between $1.5 million and $2 million in revenue, 10 of us. And so we're one of the bigger firms with a larger client. But I frankly, you know, I tell my clients, hey, how do I close these people? And I say, everybody you talk to is going to tell you they can beat the market. And frankly, that's not true. Because, you know, like all the children in Lake Wobegon can't be above average.
Right.
And I'm not going to tell you that. We're going to get you market rates of return. And we don't do a risk tolerance test to see how much risk you can stand. I do a risk analysis to find out how much risk is appropriate for you. And we build your portfolio along that line, and we use a lot of indexes because we believe in low-cost investment, very tax-efficient. We use some outside money managers that I screen. I don't take any kickbacks. And I think the big thing that, as a matter of fact, it was just a lawyer that hired us with a big company as a general counsel. And he says, the reason I hired you is that when I talk to all these AUM people, they all have big conflicts of interest, because when I retire in 2 years, I am going to have $2 million in my 401k plan, and they're going to want me to roll that over to have them manage it. And that's a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and for us, it doesn't matter to me. They can leave it there. I'll give them advice. And a lot of times it is to roll it to Schwab because we have more selection. But then there are other times, if they're doing Roth conversions with IRAs or something, they're better off leaving it where it is.
Right.
And so I think one of the key things of the Cambridge model is the way that we charge clients is based on proprietary formulas. It's based on their assets, income, the complexity of the situation. And it's not an hourly model. I don't think you can make a decent living in this business with an hourly model. And
right.
That's why most Garrett planners end up doing assets under management. And I think because, you know, when I started 40 years ago, I was a lawyer, and assets under management seems to me to be not as bad as commissions, but it's still an outrageous conflict of interest. And now even in NAPA, you know, they recognize that it is and that there's certain requirements. But the other thing that I think that when I talk to clients that impresses them about us is, one is our level of credentials and competence in our firm, and I think most ACA members certainly have a CFT. Actually, I don't have one of those because I started before the CFT when I started grandfathered me in. But all of my employees have CFTs if they're meeting with clients. And we also require tax where you're registered to practice before the IRS, either as an attorney, CPA, or enrolled agent. And so we offer a much more comprehensive approach to financial planning. Most people who call them financial planners are really investment advisors, and that's what they live and die by, basically. Whereas, you know, we do our clients' personal 1040s. Not all ACA members do that, but the system is very much geared toward understanding taxes and showing people how to integrate their taxes with their investment and so that they get really an optimum result. For, you know, example, how do you invest Roth money differently than IRA money, differently than 401k money, differently than qualified money? And we have, you know, a system worked out to optimize the tax efficiency using those vehicles. And most other people who are really doing an investment thing, they don't even, first of all, really understand necessarily all the tax implications. But they certainly don't have that kind of an approach because all they, you know, they usually don't even get paid on their client's 401k. I mean, it's not like we're paid directly on it, but it counts as part of their assets, and so it figures into our fee calculation. And so I think the two bottom lines that people hire us is, one, when I say, you know, we can promise to get you market rate of return, and that's all we do. And second is that we sell sleep. And so by actually doing a very comprehensive job, our clients' wills are up to date, and, you know, they're very tax efficient, and their insurance policies are up to date, and we generally keep it simple. We don't go into really fancy things in insurance sales and try to sell them. And we do their personal taxes and a lot of tax planning, and we do an investment allocation and watching their investments that where we're not trying to do market timing. We're just trying to keep clients balanced. And so in terrible times like these, as well as 2008, I mean, our clients love us because one of the things that we use a lot of are treasury ladders, bond ladders with treasury bonds. And so, you know, parts of, and for retired people, maybe half of their portfolio might be in treasury, long-term treasuries. So yesterday, you know, our clients about broke even because of their treasuries. The treasuries went up. I don't know how they can lower the U.S. debt, our debt rating, and then have the treasuries yield drop. But this is an interesting world. So I don't know. Maybe other people can add more to that.
Well, I would say that I basically think that I've had people who've actually, you know, been shopping around, I think the advantage that they saw, and I've actually told them this, is, you know, here's what you're going to pay at another place, and here's what I'm going to charge,
But at the other place, they're just going to manage your investments. And I'm going to do a whole comprehensive plan, and I'm going to save you money on taxes, and I'm going to do your taxes. And I think that's a very sticky part of the whole model, too, is because you're doing taxes for them. And not everybody actually does the tax preparation. Some people farm that out and work it out, so that, but they're still very heavily involved in the tax planning. And then part of the Cambridge model is that you're always telling clients how much you save them in taxes when you do various strategies or, you know, whatever you're doing to do that, that they people really get attached to their tax preparers.
And what, you know, taxes is obviously a central theme here. What type of comment if you could is just kind of a sidebar. What is the liability associated here, and have you had any problems, or have any of the ACA advisors had any liability problems or legal problems on the tax preparation side? You know, obviously, not everybody in the ACA system is a CPA that is, you know, fully qualified. I understand that they're probably enrolled agents, but there's certainly a liability issue there. And how do people address that and come to terms with that? And has that been a problem for anybody?
Well, I am not an enrolled agent. And basically what I've done is if I have anybody who has a complex enough tax return that they really ought to have a CPA, I either have them stay with their current CPA, or I, you know, send them to a good CPA. But, you know, for example, I had some people come to me, two business partners that were running a construction firm, and they were working with somebody who was preparing their taxes for their S-Corp, but was not qualified. And because I go to tax school every year, I picked up on the fact that they weren't taking the domestic production, forget what it's called, credit, and activities credit. And so I sent them to a real CPA, and I saved them like $20,000 by amending those three returns. Well, they're going to be my clients for life, as long as I keep, you know, giving them consistent service. So,
I can comment on that. I'm a tax attorney, and we represent clients that they get on.
We're having trouble hearing you, Bert.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm a tax attorney, and and so if a client's audited, we usually take them. We represent them. In some cases go to tax court, but not very many. But there was a time, 15 or 20 years ago, when I made a big mistake on a client, and I gave him some bad advice. And, I carry E&O insurance that's offered through NHEP, and it's really inexpensive. It's about $500 a year. And the claim was for, $12,000 or something. And, as soon as it was brought up to me, I could see that I had made a mistake. And so I just called the insurance company, and they said, well, don't talk to them. We'll handle it. And they handled it and paid for them. So getting insurance for errors and omissions as a tax preparer is much less expensive than it is. It's certainly not a barrier like it would be for someone who's doing investments, especially if they're taking custody of funds.
Mm-hmm. If I can chime in here for a moment, and two things I wanted to pass on. Not all Cambridge folks do clients and do taxes, and they strictly, it's just one of those things that they outsource. But much like Karen talked about, they still remain current. They review the client's taxes, and oftentimes are working with the CPA that they outsource. They might have a preferred CPA that they outsource it to. They work with those folks, and oftentimes are the ones that, like Karen said, can point out the tax savings. But one of the things I don't think that we addressed that you asked earlier was, is the business scalable? And I heard you say earlier on that you talked about maybe 20 years down the road being able to create a practice that has value to be sold. And I think it's important for us to mention to you that within the ACA, we have someone that we have worked with to design a practice management tool that ends up with, just as you described, whether it's 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road, that you have a business, if you want it to be, whether it's even if it's a sole proprietor type practice or it's a multi-person practice, that you are doing things now. And now's the time to do it. Certainly it's easier at the outset than, you know, once you've been in practice for 10 years and you need to sort of change your systems. But it's not just about, you know, finding a buyer for someone who's trying to sell a practice. It's about implementing the right systems in place so that you have a business that is, A, scalable in the first place so that you can build a practice if that's what you want to do, and, B, that it's more readily able to be marketed and you can deliver value and you can extract the value on the practice that you've built over 10, 15, or 20 years, and that the person who's buying the practice is getting something of value that they in turn can continue to build from wherever it is that you've built it. So I think we have a fancy name for it, Arlene, if you're listening and can chime in. It's what Mr. Goad, I think, is the leader behind all that. But I think that's important for
succession planning. I am here, and I believe you would refer it to
yeah, I think we have a fancier term than succession planning.
Oh, do we have a better name?
I'm hitting home on the ACA homepage right now. But just for your purposes, you know, it's called the ACA Business Value Center.
Okay.
Is what it's called. But I get the sense from your experience, you know, you've been on Wall Street, you're working with a very well-known RIA. It sounds like you're the type of person that wants to build something that might, in fact, be a multi-planner firm that, you know, builds value, is scalable, and then has value both to you and to a future buyer. Well, certainly, even within the context of the ACA system, so to speak, those practices do exist. There are some firms that have been might have started with, you know, when Bert, you know, first got out there and started talking about, you know, the so-called ACA system, and they've been around for, maybe they're already around for a few years, but now they've been a member of ACA for 5, 10, 15 years. They're at that point, or have been at that point, where they're trying to derive value from their practice and want to understand how to do that. Well, we heard them as a board, we heard those members, and we've designed this ACA Business Value Center. We've brought on an expert, and it's not 100% turnkey or anything like that. But nonetheless, it certainly is a framework by which you can build your practice and get it to the size that you need it to be. I don't think that there's any inherent limitations within the ACA system that says, oh, you're going to cap out at $400,000 of revenue. I mean, or $1 million. You just heard Bert talk about his practice has a scale much bigger than that. We've had practices that have grown to be of Bert's size and more, and some have been sold. So, but certainly, if you still want to stay within the ACA system, you can build a practice that has revenues of that scale and size, and still be an ACA member. And there's examples. You know, I could probably toss out names, but you know, if you move down the path and want to know more, I would venture to guess that we can share those names with people, with you, and you can get a sense of what their practices are like. Or certainly we can give you a link to their website, and you can see for yourself what it's like. But
right.
I think so. That they're really, I mean, I would have to say, at least in looking at the market, if you take a straight AUM firm who does nothing, you know, sort of like, who's the biggest guy in this one that's in California? He just got sued, and he writes a column for Forbes. And, you know, he just has...
Oh, Fisher?
Oh, Fisher, yeah. He sends out stuff, and he has salesmen in every city, and they go and they close them, and then they send them to somebody who opens accounts, and then they send them to somebody who's the you know, their rep who just calls them every month to keep them happy. And he charges a percentage of assets under management. And, you know, if you're running a firm like that, you can take on, you know, 10 clients with $5 million each and may not even have to increase your staff because, you know, that's the whole thing. But by, and that's, at least the way I see it, that's not the business we're in because we do such more holistic and we have a much more personal relationship with the client. That I, at least I've found in my experience, were less scalable than that. But we, but a big practice can be done. And I think, you know, after even thinking this over, because I'm doing a keynote address for, and this is one of the items I'm going to touch on, is that the true AUM firms are eating each other's to death. There's a tremendous amount of price competition, and I know because I negotiate packages for my clients to use outside money managers, and I know how much you can talk them down in rate. You know, I've got one that's charging at 22.5 basis points, and the prices that they're able to charge are coming down, and that's because that's really all they have to offer is, you know, managing your money. And it's and that is a commodity. And
it, that's the exact word I would say. If you had to set it birth, that's what I was going to say, because I worked at a high net worth firm. And frankly, that's how you're viewed by the client at some point. If you're basically their money manager, it's a commodity. And, you know, if you're not outperforming, which so few people do, then it might as well move to the next low-cost provider. It's just not, you know, and Arlene
right.
joked at my
people,
intro that...
We're getting much smarter about this because now they're the 401ks, they're learning what you know, loads are, or the, to, you know, the assets under management fees, and they're finding out and that, you know, they can call Vanguard, and Vanguard will do it for free. You know,
right.
invest managers, and they say, well, we don't charge anything. And most of the larger mutual fund companies are moving in with doing management like that, and they're not all free like Vanguard. So, you know, they're charging 20, 30 basis points. And that's what those other firms are going to go up against. And I think that, you know, in the long term, that's, that is commoditized. And so the winner is going to be the one who charges at the lowest price.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, at one point you talked about the value proposition to both, and I think it was basically word, there's a value proposition to you as a member, and there's a value proposition to your client. And hopefully we've addressed that and to say that, you know, the value proposition to your client is that you have a much deeper, well-rounded relationship with you or us, whoever, you know, whichever, however you want to phrase it. And then the value proposition to you as a firm is that you're working with a membership organization that has every intention of assisting you at whatever level of practice you are. So, no, I hopefully we've articulated that.
I definitely get it. In the few minutes that we have remaining, I imagine that this call was scheduled for an hour, so I want to respect that. I am kind of curious. You know, there's folks that kind of come into this business from different directions. For instance, Karen, I think you mentioned that you were a career changer, and John, you came from KPMG. Bert, you've been in this business probably longer than all of us. I'm kind of curious to know, you know, the ACA system has been around. I guess by now there's probably a pretty good, database or footprint of what a typical advisor does at, you know, in terms of revenues at year one, year two, year three, et cetera, et cetera. Just kind of, you know, can you paint a picture for me in terms of, you know, what are realistic expectations? Kind of like a high, low, and a middle case scenario for like the 1, 3, and 5 year checkpoints for a typical advisor that you feel, in your opinion, really follows the ACA system in a dedicated fashion?
Well, I'm happy to address that unless someone else wants to chime in.
I'm going to let you go first, John, and then this is Arlene. I have comments too.
Okay. Well, I was on the we have different committees that you volunteer for and things of that nature, and I was with the marketing committee where sort of how we attract people like you to the ACA, and then that is a question that comes up, and this, of course there's all sorts of different profiles, and quite frankly, what my experience was, and because I met with nearly every new advisor that comes in, I still do. It just ends up being something that I do a lot of. That is more or less driven by you. The ones that are driven to build a practice and really do it from the outset and do it well, they can expect to pick up, anywhere between a half a dozen to two dozen clients, full retainer clients in the first year. And that's a wide range. San Francisco has a different tolerance for fees than Cincinnati, or a client base. Who is it you're trying to attract? So I'm not trying to avoid the question and say that here's a range, but for someone who's just looking to keep a nice small a career changer that says, you know what, I'm doing this, as a second career. I'm easing out of my full-time career. They might be interested in only picking up a half a dozen or eight clients a year. Or someone who's, maybe like yourself that has seen what a decent-sized business can be and wants to fully function. And it's not unusual to pick up 10 to 15 to 20 clients in the first year and grow from there and be in a full practice in a shorter period of time than the person who's growing it slowly or gradually. So again, I'm not trying to avoid the question, but it ends up being turned back on the person who's trying to build their practice, and it almost invariably grows at the rate at which they want it to grow.
I'm sorry.
I did recruiting in my early days with the ACA, and I'm pretty sure this holds true. I found that where the person came from, for example, advisors who came from and they were working for firms or were life insurance sales and they were in the business, they tended to do much better, like maybe $100,000, $125,000 in revenue the first year, because they know how to market and they have a flow of prospects. And that was about a third of them. About a third are like CPAs who are looking to add financial planning to their practice. And interestingly, they didn't grow as fast as I expected they would because they have a hard time letting go of their CPA practice. They got to decide to stop auditing. And then the ones who did the slowest were people who had never been in financial, they were just maybe a career changer, and they got their CFP, and they didn't really know how to market. As John mentioned, some of them were actually part-timers. That took them a lot longer to get off the ground, and it was really hard for them to get their first $50,000 of revenue. At least that's how I thought. I don't know. Arlene, you probably have more current statistics.
Well, when I get this question, and we do get it fairly frequently, I always have to cop out and say it's really, really hard to tell you specific numbers because of everything John and Bert said. We have people coming from such different backgrounds with different goals, different hunger levels, if you will. And a person who's aiming for a boutique practice and working full-time works very, very differently than a person who is all ACA all the time and wants to have 100 retainer clients by the time it's all done. I generally quote that it is realistic to think of getting a client a month if you're truly doing all of the networking and marketing that you need to do and not hiding out behind your desk hoping people find you. So that's probably, it's a kind of a complex question. There's no nice, concise answer is sadly my answer for you.
And I think that what the kind of client that you're aiming for makes a difference too. I mean, if you're aiming for sort of the middle of the road, not real high wealth clients, of course those fees are going to be much lower than if you are targeting, you know, higher net worth individuals who are going to have much higher fees. So you know that plays into it too.
I don't think Arlene is off by very much when you say a client a month, and then if you layer what Karen just said into that, if you're looking at the an annual fee of $3,000 to $5,000 a year, we'll do the math. Or if you're looking at a client base where $5,000 is probably more of a minimum, and it's $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, or $8,000 in annual revenues per client, still the
And our clients are more like $10,000, $12,000, and $15,000 the first year.
Right. So a client a month times whatever your projected revenue for the client that you're going after is probably a reasonable formula to follow.
Okay. Well, let me be a little bit more blunt then. I'm sure you can all respect that we all live in different parts of the country, and the cost structure is radically different in Cincinnati from, say, San Francisco and Silicon Valley, where there's dot-coms blossoming all around here, and the social media networking space is really skyrocketing local real estate prices. The capital needs for anybody that starts a business out here are substantially higher than, say, somebody in a lower cost part of the country, and so I guess my concern is that you're partly addressing this, but I guess my point blank question is, if somebody had a financial number or goal that they absolutely needed to attain within a certain period of time because that will support their cost of living, and that number was in the $500,000 per year range, is that attainable? Has it been your experience from witnessing other advisors that have done this system correctly and have really done it in a dedicated fashion, is that achievable in a 3 to 5 year period of time?
I'm thinking of members that we have in that area, and I'm thinking of one in particular. I bet that member is somewhere in that range.
Without
confidentiality.
Sure.
I mean, no question about it. That's a big target to hit.
Right.
But like you said, it's relative to your area.
Right.
I think that this system as a system provides it's probably the lowest cost component of your overhead. Like you said, rental space is probably more expensive than signing up to be an ACA member. That's probably a drop in the bucket compared to, it might be 1 month's rent in your area.
Right.
If, in fact, you feel that you need to be in a high-rent district to meet with your clients.
Mm-hmm.
So, frankly, your bigger concern is finding the right space rather than the right, the cost of membership to the ACA.
Right.
It's all relative, right? I mean, and you're, as Arlene articulated, your hunger, desire, drive, motivation will be a bigger component to you achieving that so-called number rather than, the system holding you back. I don't think it's going to be the system holding you back. It'll be the influences outside of...
Right. Well, let me rephrase. John, I guess my question is, I understand that it all comes down to individual, and I'll be perfectly, I'm willing to be accountable for that. I guess my question is, what have you observed? And I ask that question knowing that the ACA system has been in place for quite some time now, and so I would imagine that you have the benefit of looking at people that did it right, people that didn't do it right, people that did it in certain, you know, geographic areas. And you have what you have access to is information and a tremendous deep database of people and just the history of seeing people do this system. And you've probably seen some people that just kind of petered out and some people that kind of knocked the cover off the ball. And I realize that it comes down to the individual, but I'm just trying to understand, in practice, what have you observed? Do people kind of get to a certain level and then transition to another model, or do they get to a certain level and just keep going? Or what typically happens for folks that have the aspiration to kind of grow to that level? What are you observing in practice? And forget, strip out, you know, it comes down to the individual, but what are you observing? What does the data show?
I'd have to say that to be generating $500,000, I presume you mean gross revenue?
That's take home to the owner of the practice is what I'm thinking.
So you're thinking you're going to need $1 million worth of gross revenue in five
that's
years?
Right. Yeah, that's now, probably...
That would be an outlier. I think if you look at that kind of money, you really have to do assets under management.
Right.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but do you guys, am I off base on that?
No, if that's net, I agree with you, Bert.
Here's what I would say. There's no question that's an outlier to the, if you surveyed the 100, if you took a view of the 170 or so members that we have, that is an outlier on the right side of the bell curve, no question. However, to your point, the people that had the system in place, utilized it to its best extent, those numbers are attainable. But I'm not, you know, again,
right.
There's caveats left, right, and all over the place that says, you know, those are not indicative of, you know, average returns, no question about it. But, I can think of... there's a member in the Salt Lake City area that sold their practice for well in excess of those gross revenues. I remember before they sold their practice, they put them up on the board at the annual conference and said, "This is what you can grow to be." You know, there's a member probably in the San Francisco area that, like using your term, took the system and hit the cover off the ball, and I don't doubt for a second that their revenues are in that area. There are outliers. There's no question about it, but it can be done. And I'm not saying it to be a pushy marketing person and have you join.
Right.
I'm just saying it's attainable.
Two really quick questions, and I apologize. We're past 10 o'clock, and I know that I have to jump here in a second, and I imagine you all do too. So I'll be brief. Question number one, this is a retainer system where it sounds like the fees are collected on a quarterly basis. Can you comment really briefly, and I'm just looking for data here, what is the observed attrition rate for clients that do not renew their engagement with a typical ACA advisor? I'm just looking for data here.
95% of our clients renew.
Okay, 95%.
Yeah,
my rate as well.
Okay, so that's very good. Okay, very good. The genesis for my question is one of the benefits I perceive of the AUM model is that, you know, the fees kind of silently come out of the account on a quarterly basis. It's not the check writing experience is much more personal and material to somebody than say when the fees kind of come out silently in the middle of the night. So I was curious on that.
Well, a lot of members do use credit card drafts, and they just bill monthly. They have an automatic billing, you know, quarterly or monthly. So it's not everybody has clients who have to write that check every quarter.
Right. And my second question is, Bert mentioned wealth management. My sense is that some advisors do have an AUM element to their practice. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay, and is that a way to augment or supplement the revenue that you would get through the retainers?
Well, the ones that I know do that have, you know, for example, they may do money management for philanthropic organizations or something like that, where they aren't really doing financial planning.
Okay.
And in the formulas we use, it does take into account assets, including real estate, though. We include the real estate assets. And
right.
So, but it's geared where I think for most Cambridge advisors, it's a flat annual retainer, and we usually hold it steady for 2 or 3 years, and then we raise everybody 10% to 30%. And so we don't have the phenomenon where, you know, your revenue could drop 50% in a year because, you know, the market fell off like in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Our revenues are much more even and predictable.
Right. Right, which is very important.
Yeah.
Good. Well, folks, I appreciate your time. I imagine everybody's got other things to do, and I'm flattered and honored that you were able to commit so much time to just one person. So thank you very much for all of your time. As a follow-up, I would be thrilled for the opportunity to speak. You mentioned, I think it was John, you mentioned somebody in the San Francisco Bay Area that has a successful practice. To the extent that you're willing and able to do so, I'd love the opportunity to, you know, maybe take that person out for a cup of coffee at some point in the next month or two, if you're willing to part with that information.
Well, I'll follow up with that. But I will say this, you know, me personally, if you have questions further down the road, feel free to contact me directly. But I think between Arlene and Kim, I'm not certain who allows themselves to be contacted or not. But if that's the case, you know, I think that will be handled by Arlene or Kim.
It does get handled by us. And I don't know that I've ever had anybody who said they wouldn't talk to someone.
Okay.
It's not, we're just not that private a group. So that should be no problem at all. So I'll probably let Kim take over on that one.
Okay.
Because that's her deal. But we'll work on that. And she may have other folks she wants you to get in touch with. That's kind of part of the routine.
Sure.
When folks are checking out, doing all their due diligence, is that they have some rather lengthy conversations with some of our members to get those questions answered. So.
Great. Yeah. It would be very important for me to speak with people that have a practice of the scale that I'm kind of talking or I envision kind of developing and growing this to. So that would be it would be helpful for me to speak with folks like that. If you're willing and able to do that, I'd be very appreciative.
Okay, I will refer that on to Kim to get her on that and make sure it's okay. But like I said, in the things that I do, I have a slightly different angle, but same basic premise. If I have folks that need to talk to other members, they're just rarely saying no, unless they're
Correct.
Really, you know, out of the country or something, some extenuating circumstances. Excellent. So, okie dokie. Well, thanks so much for being here, and thanks to everybody for sharing. I really appreciate it.
Great. Appreciate everybody's time.
Day.
Thanks again.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks. Bye-bye, everybody.